From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Syria's army has advanced against ISIS up to the Iraqi border as the country's military is pushing the remaining terrorists out. Despite the fact that ISIS is almost gone, however, U.S. forces don't seem to have a plan to withdraw. RT's Jacqueline Vuga has more.
ISIL has been losing territory in Syria at breakneck speed, and its all-out defeat looks to be on the horizon. Even the U.S. seems to agree on that front.
Secretary Tillerson has engaged a great deal of sort of personal diplomacy on Syria, well, the defeat of ISIS. And now that ISIS, in terms of as a physical caliphate, will be gone by the end of the year.
Syria has, in fact, already declared victory over ISIL and issued a warning to the U.S. that it's high time they left as well. And that shouldn't be a problem, given that Trump himself has said that America's interest in Syria is reserved to fighting Islamic State.
We have very little to do with Syria other than killing ISIS.
So theoretically, if ISIL only has a couple of months left, then so does the U.S. presence in Syria, right? Don't hold your breath. The U.S. Secretary of Defense James Mattis recently hinted at what the U.S. will need to see before they leave. Mattis says U.S. soldiers have a right to be in Syria despite Damascus's objections.
The U.N. said that ISIS, basically we can go after ISIS, and we're there to take them out. But that doesn't mean we just walk away and let ISIS 2.0 pop back around.
But that remark about the UN isn't 100% true. The U.S. does not have a UN mandate to deploy, let alone station troops, in Syria. A UN Security Council resolution only authorized sanctions to be used against ISIL, such as freezing assets or an arms embargo. But nowhere is troop deployment to a sovereign country mentioned. And the Syrian Democratic Forces, one of the groups who the U.S. backs and who happens to be at odds with Damascus, have welcomed America's long-term plan for Syria.
They have a strategy for decades to come. There will be military, economic, and political agreements in the long term between the leadership of the northern areas and the U.S. administration.
So while ISIL is on its way out, all signs point to the Pentagon digging in.
We spoke with a former U.K. ambassador to Syria. He was also the former U.K. ambassador to neighboring Bahrain. His name is Peter Ford, and we spoke with him via Skype from London Saturday. Peter, a pleasure to have you on. For the first time in 5 or 6 years, I won't say I'm optimistic about the situation for the people there, but it certainly looks better than it did a year ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's no thanks to my country, the UK, or to yours.
Or mine, yeah, right.
Or anybody in the West. In fact, right. All we have done is managed to put spokes in the wheel and delay the ultimate success of the pesky Ruskies and the Syrian government forces against ISIS. They're now involved in basically mopping up operations. There is still one town right on the border with Iraq to be cleared out. And the ISIS people, many of them have just gone underground, shaven off their beards and melted back into the general population.
Yeah, right.
I'm sure we will be hearing more from them. But as an organized fighting force, it looks like curtains by the end of the year.
Yeah, that's the way it seems. And that's more or less what President Putin stated the other day, that it's, we're in the mop-up at the end stage. Then, of course, there's a tremendous amount of damage. I mean, the word doesn't do justice to what's been done to Syria, the physical plant, the buildings, and all of that, and the people, and the society, and the culture, and everything. Once the killing and the bombing and everything stops, now you have the task of, addressing all of that as well ahead of us.
Absolutely. Although if you take the long view of history, you will see that Syria has seen one disaster after another, whether it's earthquakes or whether it's man-made, the Crusades, or the fight for independence in the 1940s. The destruction on the scale of the last 6 years is absolutely immense. Having said that, I'm relatively optimistic. Bear in mind that Syria is largely an agricultural country, and fortunately, most of the fields have not been blown up. And I would expect the agriculture sector to be the first to get back on its feet. Much will depend on whether how quickly the exiles can return. And I would expect the Syrian government to give them inducements, get back those millions of people just across the border in Turkey, in Lebanon, and in Jordan.
Yeah. You know, just for our listeners' benefit, you did a stint as ambassador from the UK to Syria, 2003, 2006 is what the bio I'm looking at says.
Right.
Also to Bahrain. And so you have a sense, obviously, of the government-to-government contacts. We have this, you know, war that's been declared on, you know, and one of, let's destroy it, turn it into what they did to Libya. In the aftermath of that, okay, so the war ends, hopefully soon. The task of reconstruction begins. Syria, the UK, the US, Russia, Iran, Saudi, all these countries are still, you know, on the stage, and they have to deal with each other. What kind of challenges do you think, say, the UK is going to face, you know, going forward in, you know, dealing with the aftermath?
Well, I've been saying for 5 years that all these countries just need to butt out. That includes my country, the US, the Iranians, and the Russians. If the Syrians had been left to sort out their own problems, it would all have been over much, much more quickly. But we are where we are, and these outside players continue to play an important role. Realistically, what matters most now is that Russia and Iran continue to stand alongside the Assad government, which they almost certainly will, and they will ensure that government's survival against all odds. So, in fact, that is now virtually a foregone conclusion. But the outsiders, my country, the US, Saudi, are outside the tent pissing in, I'm sorry to say, trying to hamper reconstruction, trying to, they're stalking Assad. All this nonsense about use of chemical weapons, most of the nonsense about atrocities, it's just stalking. And sour grapes, because they back the losers in the shape of the Syrian opposition. They believed wrongly that there were many thousands of moderates out there. These proved to be just phantasms. The only folks out there who were fighting Assad were jihadis.
Yep. Yeah, the you know, it's interesting that you frame it that way as well. The United States, for example, over the period of the 6 years or whatever since February of 2011, almost 7 years, has you know, dropped. Here's $10 billion. We're going to go recruit some more moderate rebels, and only to find that the 500 moderate rebels or 1,000 moderate rebels that they were supposedly training and arming or whatever evaporated into thin air. And suddenly the weapons ended up in the hands of jihadis. New group, old group, or as Mark Sloboda says, one of the 57 varieties of jihadis. that's kind of been happening a lot in these different regime change operations that the U.S. has. We saw the narrative that was applied to Libya, for example, certainly cannot be applied to explain the conditions on the ground in Libya now. Clearly, what they said was happening wasn't, and instead, what many of us were saying was happening at the time, and people inside Libya were saying, is that you had foreign jihadis that were coming into Libya, backed by the U.S. and U.K. and French Air Force, that conquered the country, in essence. They were killing black Libyans, calling them mercenaries. They were destroying the place. And, you know, it was an invasion and not an uprising. Same in Syria, more or less, although there was maybe a larger indigenous component to it.
Yeah, that's right. I'm afraid the Pentagon generals and their acolytes in London and Paris and elsewhere could never see a hornet's nest there anywhere without wanting to give it a good kick.
Yeah,
and see what happened, with predictable results. We had it first with the support for the Taliban. Remember that one? That didn't end very well.
Yep.
And as you mentioned, Libya, then we got rid of Saddam and just blew the powder keg there. There was no jihadi terrorism in Iraq until we went in there. And similarly, we made the situation much worse in that respect by trying to topple Assad.
Yeah, and also the other thing that their big fear is now in geopolitical terms is of a Shiite crescent, and a Shia crescent, and there was really no consideration in any deep sense of Sunni Shia, et cetera, in the geopolitics of the region until the U.S. created the situation, and what they did was take what was in essence a Sunni state that was allied with the United States and turned it into a Shia state that's allied with the revolutionary government in Iran that was the big enemy number one, you know, only 35 years ago.
Exactly. When you look at actual results of U.S. Military initiatives, or rather adventures, you see that they've all backfired. Iran was the main beneficiary in Iraq. Iran is one of the main beneficiaries now over Syria, and stands to be a main beneficiary over Yemen. Plus, recently, President Trump took sides with Saudi Arabia against Qatar. And guess what? Qatar is now getting into bed with Iran.
Oops. Yes, it's true. I mean, there are a number of other things. I don't think we've yet seen the manifestation of what the potential of this thing here. But even though the Saudis and the Israelis have been allies and have had allied interests for many years, this has always been under the covers. And, you know, with, I guess you'd say plausible, but in any event, deniability. And suddenly conditions have reached a point where they are now openly discussing, you know, this fact that they are allied. In fact, the implications of that are pretty interesting on the ground there, with particularly among some of the fundamentalists that have been spawned by the Saudis.
That's right. The interesting thing is that most of the fundamentalists are not interested in Israel at all.
Yeah.
And they, in fact, they have literally trampled on the Palestinian flag.
Yeah.
They don't like Palestinian nationalism or any other Arab nationalism. They want just the Ummah, the Arab or the Islamic nation, or all brothers together, no individual states. You know, the caliphate was supposed to expand indefinitely across the Islamic world. So they're no supporters of the Palestinians, and they don't care very much about the Jews. It's not part of their rhetoric. They're much more focused on schisms, as they see it within Islam, essentially on fighting the Shia.
Sounds a lot like the American and European left.
Don't want to go there.
Yeah. But well, it's another religion, perhaps. The situation in the region includes, what's developed in Bahrain since the so-called Arab Spring, which in essence was a peaceful, popular, widespread uprising, and which a genuine one, an indigenous one, a spontaneous one in many ways, and essentially the suppression of that by Saudi Arabia and occupation by the Saudis, and all of this in a country where, I don't know, half the real estate is a U.S. naval base.
Exactly, and the double standards of the West were blatant. We loved to see secular strongmen toppled, Saddam. Well, when the Arab Spring got going, it was the president of Tunisia, it was Gaddafi, it was Mubarak, it was going to be Assad. You know, we never saw a secular leader, an anti-Islamist leader that we didn't want to overthrow. Whereas when it came to the kings and the little kings of the Gulf, wow, they could get away with blue murder.
And in Saudi Arabia now, there's been very volatile political situation. Given the conditions that people face there in the 21st century, moving forward into the 14th in political culture, there's always a sort of a latent potential for an immediate release of political energy. But you're seeing things that are really volatile now, and I'm wondering what you think the implications of that are for the for the region.
Well, I think I need to reread my copy of The Godfather before I say very much, because that is exactly what's going on. It's just the clans and mafiosi and capos. We have a new capo on the block in Mohammed bin Salman, and it's family members against other family members. Yeah, it's the Godfather. Mm. Not only just at the level of Saudi Arabia, but almost the whole of Middle East politics could be read in terms of mafia activity.
Yeah, I wonder who's going to end up playing Mo Green in that scenario. another interesting development, though, in the midst of all of that, all of the palace intrigue there and the purges and such, was a visit by Salman to Moscow. It's not unprecedented, but unusual and sort of a... we're all oil-producing countries. Let's start to coordinate our policy some kind of discussions coming out of both Russia and Saudi Arabia. And that at the same time, by the way, that Russia is picking up, essentially shoring up the debt of Venezuela, another large oil producer. I'm wondering if oil politics are going to sort of present and as well the realignment, or in any event, the change relations between Turkey and Russia, the improvement relations, and some of that over a pipeline. If all of the economic issues and the potential, alliances for oil are going to have an impact on changes basically in the geopolitical situation there.
I think all the players are agreeable to compartmentalizing their oil policy and their military security policies. So Saudi is ready to cooperate with Russia on the oil price and with anybody else. Mm. And this has no bearing whatever on how they're going to behave in Syria or with regard to Iran or whatever. And bottom line is that these countries know they have to live, and the oil price is absolutely crucial to them.
Yeah. And it's interesting, though, because there are some sort of drag-alongs that go with that. On the one hand, the Saudis may decide we are going to be, on the side of the U.S. as against Russia in general or in this or that geopolitical struggle. On the other hand, one of the weapons that... the U.S. has used against Russia and also against Venezuela was tanking the oil prices, tanking commodity prices generally. And if you have the Saudis less, they're also less able because of what's happened to their own economy over that, but less inclined to play some of those games, there's an impact on the geopolitical situation, even, despite the intents of the parties, let's say.
Yeah, but don't forget, Don, it's not very long ago that tensions were high between the U.S. and Saudi over shale.
Yeah.
And it appeared at one moment that the U.S. was ramping up on shale to do down the Saudis. But again, personally, I think this was compartmentalization. The U.S. had its shale policy for its own particular reasons, nothing much to do with relations with Saudi Arabia.
Right. And then there's so many contradictions, because on the one hand, in order to make the shale competitive, you would need to drive up the oil prices from, you know, the Russia, Venezuela, particularly Saudi mm-hmm. Arabia. And mm-hmm. for other geopolitical considerations, they actually drove them down, which made shale, you know, not competitive at all, and more or less chilled that whole, you know, explosion that was yeah. taking place in that business.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's ironic that Saudi and Russia share this interest in driving up the oil price. In fact, Russia stands to be the biggest beneficiary.
Yeah, that's true. Let's see. What do you think is going to present as maybe the next conflict in that area, with all of the moving parts? They're trying to coalesce a political situation in Libya. You could see even at the UN yesterday or the day before, the discussions about that, that there's a lot to do just in terms of preparatory work before anything actually gets done there. Of course, in Syria, we had what happened at the UN yesterday, you know, the U.S. And Russia on opposite sides of the question of, you know, they're still, the U.S. is still trying to stir this whole thing over chemical weapons, basically, which seems pointless. Also, Yemen, you know, the U.S. has sort of backed off of Syria. It's allowing the development of what's developed there to occur without too much interference. It's different than it was with Obama, for certain. And likewise with Yemen, those spots that were bombed, you know, where the U.S. participated in bombing in Yemen directly, as opposed to the AWACS assistance and everything to the Saudis, they actually bombed Al-Qaeda instead of bombing, quote-unquote, Houthis, in other words, Yemenis. So what do you think is like... there's a lot of moving parts. What do you think is going to start presenting, say, in 2018, like for the next phase?
The one to watch is U.S. relations with Iran, which might come to a head in Lebanon. I'm not predicting that. In fact, I think on the whole, it's likely that we'll escape a major crisis over that. But that has the capacity to go very badly wrong, as it did in 2006 when Lebanon was devastated by a war launched by Israel, which ended in a stalemate. The Israelis didn't even secure any of their hoped-for gains, but it's been followed by 11 years of peace on Israel's northern border. The Galilee has never had such a sustained period of peace. And why is that? Because Hezbollah, whether we like them or not, have held the ring in Lebanon and literally prevented Sunni jihadis lobbing Katyusha rockets across the border at Israel. And there's been the stability that comes from mutual deterrence. And it's this stability which risks being upset by the Pentagon general's policy towards Iran, and the egging on of Israel into rash acts. But if I may come back, Don, to the issue you raised earlier about the Syria and chemical weapons and the vote in New York.
Yes.
Forgive me if I go into a little bit of detail here.
No, please do.
It's very interesting.
Yes.
When you read the report done by the international inspectors into the incidents of April earlier this year, it's fascinating reading, because it raises as many questions as it answers. Now, the inspectors came to the conclusion that it was Syria what did it. But if you go to the trouble of reading the 68 pages of the report, and you have half a brain, you will not come to that conclusion. But you'll have to have your wits about you and know a little bit about what's going on and reach at least section 77 of Annex 2, which is fascinating. It shows that there were 248 cases reported to hospital, right? Of those, 57 reported before the alleged incident even happened. And 10 of those cases presented in hospitals 80 miles away.
Whoa.
Now, you know, maybe in some parallel universe, it's possible.
It sounds like a Star Trek episode, yeah.
But, you know, you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to work out that something fishy going on here, and this story just doesn't stack up.
Yeah, I mean, this is the essence. This is the essence of the disagreement between the U.S. and Russia: is the methodology that was applied and the chain of custody of the materials that were being examined. Like, where did this stuff come from? Well, we don't know.
Exactly. Well, we do know it came through
from the bad guys, right? Yeah, right.
Who have their own biases and came from Idlib, the province of Idlib, which is in jihadi hands.
Right.
So you're sort of believing Al-Qaeda over everybody else.
Right. And by the way, an act of faith on top of it with Al-Qaeda that, okay, let's say they're telling the truth about where this came from. There's still gaps from here's the material to here's the conclusion. And just the whole methodology is ridiculous.
Exactly. The inspectors, again, on a point of detail, they lay great store by the fact that the sarin samples that they got hold of had the signature of those in the Syrian government chemical weapon stocks, which were 96% destroyed, according to other UN inspectors. Now, the missing 4%, guess where that was? That was in rebel-held areas that the UN wasn't able to inspect.
Right.
And one of those areas was, yeah, you guessed it, near the place where the alleged attack took place.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting to see how the inconsistent presentation from the U.S. side and at the U.N., at the Security Council, and from the U.S.'s allies. If you go back to that plane that was shot down, the jetliner that was shot down over Ukraine back, you know, a few years back, the local militias had said, why don't you guys come here and inspect the site, come take, you know, look at everything on the ground. There, we don't have to do that. We don't need to come there. You know, here, you know, you're not allowed to go. Under normal conditions, a forensic study would be, okay, these are samples that you collected, fine. We're going to take those. We're going to the site. You go to the site as soon as possible, assuming that those who were involved are going to try to, you know, manipulate the evidence, you know, mess around with it. It's going to naturally decay and et cetera, et cetera. And instead, an opposite. The game looks like they're hiding something.
Exactly. That's just what happened in the case of Syria. The inspectors didn't want to visit the site of the incident itself, and they delayed visiting the airport from which the Syrian military aircraft took off.
Yep. Yeah, so, well, we're going to have to keep an eye on this and see how it develops. Unfortunately, for the Syrian people and for humanity generally, it's not over yet. Fortunately, it appears that it's close to being over, and I think that's a good thing, and we can only hope that we're not going to see this kind of craziness break out again, although I'm not hopeful on that point. Peter, thank you very much for your time and for all the work that you do. Thank you.
Anytime.
Thanks. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.